Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What makes us believe the human race was finished upon the diaspora of Homo sapiens from Africa 50,000 years ago? Is it possible we are still evolving? And do the environments we create for ourselves have the power to influence the ways that we change? Gregory Cochran has found strong evidence to suggest they do. He's a physicist and adjunct professor of anthropology at the University of Utah. His latest book, written with Henry Harpending, is called The 10,000-Year Explosion, How Civilization Accelerated Human Evolution. Gregory, welcome to Think.
Hello.
Let's start by talking about the Great Leap Forward, 40 to 50,000 years ago in Europe. What happened during that time?
Well, that's the time in which modern humans around that time replaced Neanderthals. This probably was completed by about 30,000 years ago. And they exhibited much more complicated cultural abilities than the Neanderthals. They started to produce art, you know, the famous cave paintings. Their tools were more complicated. There was very rapid change. That is, you know, by the typical standards of human change in the past. If you look in Africa, things changed, but you might have to wait 50,000 years for the change to be really noticeable. Here, there was a lot of change in a short period.
And a lot of scientists said, well, there you have it. They were able to achieve all these things. Therefore, the end of evolution had come. You're convinced that all of that really spurred evolution.
Because all too often when you solve one problem, you create another. or even if you solve a problem that really was there, that changes the balance of things. It changes the balance of costs and so forth. If you're in a situation where, how can I say this? For example, suppose you have a new kind of weapon and it's better. Maybe that means that you don't have to hunt as a group. Maybe you can hunt by yourself or in smaller groups. But the point is that means that your kind of society is changing, and eventually, you know, the mix of personalities that works best will be different too. Maybe there's more room for loners if you now have a bow and arrow, that sort of thing. You know, almost anything you do that makes a major change eventually changes the sort of person, the sort of body, the sort of mind that would work best in that situation.
Mm-hmm. So, for example, and we're going back now in history, but 2.5 million years ago, the first humans started using tools. And you saw that really as the first cultural innovation that served as a force of biological change.
Well, it's the first one that we know about. I mean, mm-hmm. There might have been some sort of social arrangements that were also had impact, but they don't leave fossils.
Right.
They don't leave records. But when early proto-humans started being able to, you know, they could, in a sense, fake the fangs, the claws, the weapons that big carnivores use. We could make our own. We started to be able to, you know, sort of create our own possibilities.
So we shape our tools, and then our tools ultimately shape the way our bodies change, our hardware, as you call it.
Right. I mean, although, you know, all of this takes time. I mean, it's not that people have changed noticeably in the past 20 years or anything, except maybe to get fatter. But in terms of biological change, it doesn't take forever. It's a compressed example, but it's enough to learn something from. You look at dog breeds. Most of the dog breeds we have not been around very long, and lots of them have changed, you know, even in the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
For example, dachshunds used to weigh about 50 pounds and were used to hunt badgers.
It's hard to imagine that now.
Well, yes, but even 20 years ago, you know, now we have mini dachshunds, and they're, you know, perhaps 15 pounds,
mm-hmm.
and we had bigger ones even 20 years ago. The fashion in dachshunds has changed. Now, that's a strong kind of selection when people do it, but the same thing can happen over a longer period from natural circumstances, and there's every reason to think it has.
So how are you able, Gregory, to track the progress of a favorable mutation of any kind from its onset to the place where it affects a large swath of the population?
Well, there are two ways. One is very simple and easy to understand, but we haven't done very much of it yet. The other is a little complicated. The simplest way is if you can dig up bodies that are, say, 6, 7, 10,000 years old and see, and they can now do some genetic analysis, at least in favorable cases, on those bodies, and you can see, did this particular gene variant exist yet? For example, and this is a example we talk about a lot, but it's an important example, the ability to digest milk as an adult. There, you know, there's a mutation that causes that in Europeans and in adjacent areas, such that many people can do this. You know, the original state of humans was this all shut off by probably age 5. And we have looked at some skeletons in Europe from 7,000 to 8,000 years ago in areas that today the great majority of people have this mutation, places like Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And back then, out of, say, you know, 15 skeletons, not one had it. So that's the most direct way, is just to look at things from the past and see it was rare then, it's common now.
And the reason that it probably continued once the mutation did happen was that people began farming cattle.
Well, people were probably already raising cows, but they probably became more useful once you could, you know, live off the milk for your, you know, for your entire life. I'm sure that even when they first raised cows at all, they occasionally gave milk to small children who were short on milk. But it becomes more useful when you can do that indefinitely, when they can continue to. It turns out that you produce food more efficiently by a dairy process than by raising cows to kill them. And it's a lot more efficient. It's perhaps 5 times more efficient. And what it means is that if you had a family who had like 2 cows and a couple of kids, they could probably kind of get by. You can survive on fewer resources.
So agriculture obviously changed our bodies, and there are other ways besides this one. Did it also change our brains?
It seems likely. I mean, there are certain things we know. Like one of the ones, which is the clearest, although we don't know exactly what it means, is the brains have gotten smaller. Again, this one's easy to see. You look at skulls from 15,000 years ago, 10,000 years ago, 5,000 years ago, and the human brain has, in many parts of the world, probably about everywhere, has shrunk somewhat by perhaps 10% from the high point, which was about 15,000 years ago. I mean, some of that may be agriculture. Whatever it is, over this time period, which is the time period agriculture showed up in many parts of the world, the human brain has shrunk. I don't know. It sounds bad, but that's but that's still a change.
Is there a relationship in human beings between the size of the brain and overall intelligence?
Some, yeah. I mean, if there wasn't, you'd expect the brains to, you know, you see, there's a lot of difficulties about having a large head. It makes birth difficult,
mm-hmm.
as many people know. If heads were smaller, it'd be a lot easier. So there'd be many advantages. You know, if you could have a smaller brain that worked just exactly as well, there'd be many advantages to it. It also uses less energy, but they've shrunk, but not that much. No, I mean, when they do studies on brain volume and IQ tests, there is some correlation, a positive correlation, between brain volume and intelligence, and there would almost have to be. Otherwise, it would be large for no reason. Large and expensive for no reason.
Let's talk about this fascinating chapter you have in the book about the remarkable intelligence as a group of Ashkenazi Jews. As a distinct ethnic group, they have the world's highest IQs.
We haven't probably tested every obscure group, but mm-hmm. yes.
So talk about how you think this happened.
Well, the way Henry and I think it happened is that you had a group that sort of by chance appeared in Europe, you know, founded by immigrants, settlers, prisoners of war back during the Roman Empire, and that later expanded into Northern Europe and had sort of specialized jobs, but at the same time had rules that almost completely prevented them from intermarrying, at least after the beginning. There's reason to think there was originally a fair amount of intermarriage, say in Roman times, but after a while, intermarriage almost stopped, again until recently where it started up again. And that's important because you can't end up different from people across the street unless you form your own closed group. If you intermarry freely with your neighbors, you'll be like your neighbors. That's inevitable. But the jobs they had were white-collar jobs. 90% of them were jobs that involved handling money, handling, running a business, things of that sort for a long time.
They were barred, essentially, from taking place in agriculture.
Yeah, although that's actually fairly common for immigrant groups to not end up being farmers.
Mm-hmm.
But there were also laws against it. And after a while, there were increasingly, you know, Jews, even in other groups other than the European Jews, were moving more into various kinds of urban jobs, not all white-collar jobs. In the Islamic world, they were predominantly things more like crafts. But in Europe, for the majority of this period, crafts were very rare. So they had white-collar jobs. And the other situation, which was, again, kind of different from today, is people who made more money had lots more children survive, which is, if anything, the opposite today.
Mm-hmm.
But what this means is, to the extent that various, if there's any inherited quality at all that helps you succeed at that job, and a success in that job then means you have six surviving children instead of two, over a long time, you'll see an increase in those qualities, whatever they are.
But remarkably, in this case, it wasn't all that long.
Well, but if you look at the numbers, think of it this way. Suppose that the people who were the parents of the next generation were just a little bit more successful than the average of the whole group. Let's suppose a part of the explanation of that was being smarter. Let's say that if you had an IQ of 90, it was sort of hard to succeed as a businessman in these situations.
Mm-hmm.
And because of things of that, perhaps it was a little easier if you had an IQ of 120. And let's suppose that the population that was the parents of each generation averaged one IQ point higher than average. That's not a lot. I doubt if anyone would have even noticed it at the time. Who could notice an average difference of 1 point? But that over 1,000 years, that's enough to generate the sort of differences we see.
So do the smart get smarter and the dumb get dumber?
Not necessarily. I mean, what it means is in each given situation, there's a payoff for smarts or for other psychological characteristics,
mm-hmm.
or for subparts of smarts, for memory, etc. And there are genes that affect these things, and over time, and they're all heritable. I mean, which is to say, you are more similar to your parents than a random draw from the population, more similar in ways that boil down to genetics. You know, even if you're adopted, you're more similar to your parents than a random draw of the population. There is some genetic influence on these things. It doesn't have to mean that explains everything, but it explains part of the trend.
Mm-hmm.
And so over time, you know, if certain things are favored, you'll get more of those things. But that, you know, exactly how what the payoff is will vary according to your culture, according to the situation, according to the technology. It's easy for it to reverse. I mean, it's reversed today. I mean, the average person with a lot of education has fewer kids than average.
Does that worry you?
Not in the short run.
Mm-hmm. But for the long run of evolution, or do you think that we'll technologically control this sort of ourselves?
This is the sort of thing that people can do something about without a miracle happening. I have, since it would take hundreds of years, probably at least 200 or 300, before you'd notice real trouble, I'd hope we could do something. I mean, it's not as if it's impossible to do something. We know things you could do. So it doesn't worry me, not infinitely. I mean, in a general sense, it's probably not a great thing. But I don't worry about it in the short run. Besides, you know, before that happens, there's every chance the robots will have taken over anyhow. But, no, it is something worth thinking about. If we had a situation, I mean, the strongest part of this is highly educated women having very few kids. If ways could be found to make that easier for them, probably would be a good thing. But it's not a trivial thing to change.
Amen. Gregory Cochran is my guest. He's a physicist and adjunct professor of anthropology at the University of Utah. His new book with Henry Harpending is called The 10,000-Year Explosion, How Civilization Accelerated Human Evolution. We would love for you to join the conversation. Give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can cultivate your curiosity at SMU and learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is physicist and adjunct professor of anthropology at the University of Utah, Gregory Cochran. His new book is called The 10,000-Year Explosion, How Civilization Accelerated Human Evolution. If you would like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Can you talk for a minute about the evolution of disease resistance throughout recent history?
Yeah, we know a fair amount about that one. I mean, as I said, a lot of these things, we know partial information. This one we know more, partly because there's a lot of medical research aimed at that sort of thing. The most famous example in many parts of the old world, the tropical areas, are you know, particular genetic changes that cause resistance to the most severe kind of malaria. And you've probably heard of sickle cell.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there are about five or six other prominent ones that do a similar thing. The symptoms are not exactly the same, but there are other genetic things. When you have two copies, are typically a genetic problem, but one copy helps protect you from malaria. Malaria was a very serious disease, and still is in many areas. And there were more rewards to defenses against it than almost anything else. There's also, we know less about it. Here we know more of the differences. We know, for example, that when smallpox would hit, say, Europeans or China, it was a serious disease. It might kill 10% of the population. But when it hit populations that had never been exposed to it at all, such as American Indians, eventually the impact was much worse.
So there might have been genetic protection experienced by the people who had lived in Europe and Asia.
Well, we know some of the details. I mean, if you look at those malaria defenses, the Indians didn't have them.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, neither does anyone in Sweden, because there's not that kind of malaria. But that one we know a lot about. We know something about some of the others, but we don't know it in the same level of detail. And this is still a problem occasionally. There can be uncontacted Indian groups in the Brazilian jungle, and when they sometimes they decide it's time to, you know, get into serious contact with the outside world. They usually know something about the outside world, but they might have pretty limited contact. But when they do, it's dangerous. They have a lot of problems. Basically, they can only do well if you have careful medical attention and inoculate them for everything. And, for example, as recently as 20 years ago, when a group didn't have that happen, most of them died over about 15 years, mostly from tuberculosis.
How important is the size of a population in terms of the speed with which its population evolves?
Well,
and the density, I guess.
There are two things you need. One is you need to have a situation in which there are improvements to be made, which generally means you're in some situation you haven't been in forever. If a creature, any species, humans, whatever, has been in exactly the same situation for, you know, millions and millions of years, they're probably already pretty good at doing the things they need to do in that situation. So the first thing you knew is there has to be sort of a poor fit. So there are improvements to be made. But the next question is you need, sometimes existing genes, you know, can solve part of that problem. If they change in frequency, certain things that already exist become more common. They're part of the response. But another part is mutations, new versions of genes. And the more people you have, the more likely you are to have a particular favorable mutation happen. You know, mutations are common, but favorable ones are rare. But if you have 100 times more people, you'll have 100 times more chances. It's just like buying lottery tickets.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Gregory Cochran is my guest. His new book is called The 10,000-Year Explosion, How Civilization Accelerated Human Evolution. Let's speak to Peter in Plano. Hi, Peter.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm a pediatrician, and I also studied anthropology in college. Mm-hmm. And I see these kids with attention deficit disorder, and I think that this was evolutionarily favored way back when, because you'd want to be a little distracted if you were hunting and gathering, and it's only now, the way we live our lives, that it's a disadvantage. I'm curious what your guest's opinion was.
That's actually something I've looked at a little, although I don't pretend to completely understand it. There might be something to what you're saying. I mean, there is a gene variant, something called DRD4-7R, which is a dopamine receptor, which has been linked in some studies to a kind of ADHD. Let's call this the good kind. You can also have kind of a bad kind, which is basically if the kid's been hit in the head or something. I mean, there are kids who have trouble concentrating because of closed head injuries and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But these kids don't show lower IQs, but they don't do what elementary teachers want them to. And that could very well have been favored. And in this particular case, there is evidence that this particular gene has become more common, not super recently, but over the past about 20,000, 30,000 years. It appears not to have always been around. It's some new form. And interestingly enough, it varies a lot from place to place. For example, it's almost unknown in China, very rare. Where typically in other places, it might be 20 to 60%. And, suspicion, it's only a suspicion, is that somehow being an easily distractible person who wasn't terribly conformist may not have worked that well in Imperial China. But we don't really know.
Gregory, are modern urban environments sufficiently alike that we can assume that, urban dwellers for the foreseeable future will evolve on sort of a parallel course?
I don't know. I mean, it's always easier to see the results of long-term trends after the long-term is already over.
Sure.
I mean, we have things are changing so rapidly that there are things that were favored in 1950 that aren't today, and yet different things may be favored another 50 years from now. I don't really know. You would get a general impression that there ought to be some similarities between people living in various big cities in different parts of the world, but I couldn't say. I mean, I wouldn't say with any confidence. It's because, like I said, the situation is too complicated and it's changing too fast.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email think@kera.org. Let's go next to Jimmy in Dallas. Hello, Jimmy.
Hello. Yes. Very interesting show. I have a question, and in the scheme of evolutionary development, civilizations spread all over the world in groups of form that did not seem to have any contact with one another. However, they would develop a tool or a type of building at the same time. How could that occur when they had no, give you an example, a spear point or perhaps a conical building, a pyramid. These were or mounds. They had no way of any touches. Well, how did that happen?
Well, one of the really background important things in this is the Ice Age ended about 11,000 years ago. And it looks like it was in a number of different places fairly shortly afterwards people started developing various kinds of agriculture, which is the first step before you can have villages and then cities and then monumental architecture like such as pyramids and things. It looks like back in the Ice Age the world was just too rough to make this work. But once but the weather changed everywhere, and so the possibility showed up to different extents everywhere. I mean, obviously some places are more favorable for farming than others, but it wasn't exactly the same time, but some of them were kind of similar. Like, the first farming is in the Middle East. A little bit later, you start seeing it on the edges of the Middle East, places like Europe. About the same time as that, it's showing up in China. It's a bit later in Africa from what we know. It's, again, a bit later, not a whole lot, not enormously later, but it's later in the Americas with, the development of corn and potatoes. But a lot of it is that, the world changed in a way that made these things possible. So a lot of different places, people started moving in that direction now that it became possible. One of the things about the Ice Age was not only was it colder, it looks like the climate was much more variable. You could have a change of 10 degrees in the average temperature over a period of 3 or 4 years. And if you started to try early farming and then somebody pulls the rug out from under you that way, these things may have been tried and failed and never gotten anywhere. But with the end of the Ice Age, climate was not just warmer, it was much more stable. So in a sense, I'd say that the environment changed in a favorable way in many of these places. And as for building pyramids, there is no simpler way to build a fairly tall thing. You certainly can't build it turned the other way.
What factors give favorable alleles a better shot at actually sticking, as opposed to being sort of a flash in the pan that never goes anywhere?
Well, any given favorable allele could disappear just by bad luck. I mean, something might give you resistance against disease X and have no real side effects, but you could still, happen to fall down a cliff. Or suppose you had no children Or suppose that neither you had several children, but by chance, none of them happened to carry that new gene you had. So chance is always a factor. But one thing that helps, of course, if the advantage is big, it's more likely to make it if it's big. Another thing that helps, if the population as a whole is already growing, that means it's less you're less likely to, say, have no children and lose it by chance. But the biggest thing is, you know, it should just be advantageous. There's many ways that can happen. You can have something that defends against a disease. There's reason to think there's things that we know of some, for example, that help you digest newly available foods better. Again, the famous one is lactose tolerance that lets you continue to drink milk as an adult. One of my boys came up with a great name for that, you know, because it's kind of strange. You know, we're living off the milk of another species. My boy Roddy called people like that mampires. it's a pretty good word for it.
And you actually slipped it into the book, as I recall.
Yeah, but I forgot to give him a credit, and I have to say it now.
On every radio show.
Pretty much, yeah.
Gregory Cochran is my guest. He's a physicist and adjunct professor of anthropology at the University of Utah. The new book is called The 10,000-Year Explosion, How Civilization Accelerated Human Evolution. Let's go next at 1-800-933-5372 to Jay in Dallas. Hey, Jay.
Yes, good afternoon. Hi, Chris. Hello, Greg.
Hello.
Chris, I really like your show.
Thank you. It's great.
I'm a vampire, too, Gregory, so. one quick point here. You were making about the native populations, a lot of them being wiped out by common viruses, things like smallpox and malaria. It reminded me of a point made in the excellent series done by Jared Diamond in Guns, Germs, and Steel. He points out that the Native American population, when they were exposed to a lot of these diseases, apparently they were wiped out so quickly because they didn't have exposure to domestic animals,
domestic
livestock. And another point he makes is that when a lot of European immigrants, I think mainly he was referring to England or the UK, when they moved to Africa, a lot of them did not do very well. A lot of them died from malaria because they didn't have any built-up immunities against that.
It's not just build up. Well, you know, there's sort of two types of immunities. One is the ones you develop in your own life. Like if you get a cold, you won't get the same cold later. If you get the measles, you won't get measles later. But the longer, more significant ones are genetic changes that make you and all your descendants more resistant. The English, when they moved to places like Central Africa, not only did they not have those personal immunities, but they didn't have those hereditary ones either. You know, things like sickle cell and so forth. And, basically, you know, whenever you had a European population in Central Africa before we had, you know, decent drugs for this, artemisinin and so forth, they died like flies. I talk about this some in the book. But, you see, Diamond talks about differences in disease resistance, but he talks about very few other differences. And my point is that, you know, if you live in a very different environment, and that environment may be something we made, you know, like the civilization that was invented or agriculture that was invented. It changes everything that makes a difference. Change in your metabolism, change in your immune system, but also changes in genes that affect personality or intelligence or cancer risk, almost anything you can name. Any change that works in that particular environment tends to be selected for. Doesn't have to be something we like. Doesn't have to be only things on a certain small list. It's you might say if evolution has a motto, it's whatever works.
Let's talk for a minute about alcohol use and alcoholism. It would seem that, although there are some benefits to alcohol use, that it's such a scourge on the population that we would have developed some kind of resistance to wanting to drink alcohol.
Well, who knows? Maybe some people have. It looks like in a lot of situations, moderate drinking of things that are kind of low in alcohol, the sort of thing that, you know, you make not distilled, those were probably a plus because it's a way to avoid a lot of things you get from polluted water supplies. You know, for example, the Roman army always liked to, you know, carry their wine with them and drink.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't because they were trying to get drunk, but it probably protected them from catching local diarrheas and things. So, moderate drinking may have been a long-term plus in most places, but certainly being an alcoholic never was. And it looks as if people who have been drinking for a very long time, and again, drinking is sort of a side effect of agriculture, you have to raise the grain before you can ferment it, that people who've been doing this for a long time have less alcoholism, not zero, but less. I would say they are, you know, you're looking at the evidence, it looks like they're somewhat acclimated to this situation, where people have been drinking for a shorter time are less acclimated, and people who started drinking yesterday are the worst. And this is an interesting contrast, for example, with things like, let's say, heroin. You see, because no one is acclimated to that. There's probably, you know, if there is such a thing as a social heroin user, it's probably kind of luck. There's no population. So this is an interesting practical differences between alcohol and all sorts of, say, new artificial synthetic drugs, is that some populations are somewhat tolerant of alcohol, but nobody is really ready for any of the new stuff.
So 10,000 years from now, theoretically, there could be a group of people somewhere on the planet that can use heroin in the way that many people can use alcohol today.
If we keep doing it forever, yeah, maybe. Or they'll be able to toke and won't have to have any brownies. There's all sorts of things like that could happen. It depends. A lot of it depends on how much trouble it causes you. I mean, if you had something that caused very little trouble, there won't be much need to respond to it. There won't be much selection pressure. And as it is, you know, the fraction of people who use a lot of heroin is pretty small, so I'm not sure it really matters. But yeah, in principle, you know, anything like that, if it hung around forever, people would adapt to getting somewhat better at dealing with it.
What percentage of a population has to have a particular adaptation in order for it to be significant in the way people live?
Well, if you wanted something that... It probably would depend upon the question. If you're talking about something that changed how people, you know, digested or metabolized a certain food, you'd think it'd have to be enough you could see. But if it was something that, you know, changed personality or something, it might be that it created a few unusual people that you hadn't had before, and maybe if those people wrote the right book or caused the right kind of trouble, they might matter even if they weren't too common yet.
My guest is Gregory Cochran. We're talking about his new book, The 10,000-Year Explosion, How Civilization Accelerated Human Evolution. We'll get to more of your calls and more of your emails after the break. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or at think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can cultivate your curiosity at SMU and learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Gregory Cochran is my guest. He's a physicist and adjunct professor of anthropology at the University of Utah. Along with Henry Harpending, his new book is called The 10,000-Year Explosion, How Civilization Accelerated Human Evolution. You can join us on the phone at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. You would characterize, Gregory, most of the sort of recent adaptations and selections as simple rather than complex, but that doesn't mean that they're not major.
It doesn't appear that anybody's developed anything as complicated as an eye. That takes longer. But there's been changes to many different things. So there's been changes in skin color. Those are pretty recent. And there's been changes in things involving digestion. There's been things involving all sorts of details of metabolism, changes in the immune system. There are changes. We don't understand them too well, but, you know, we could say, look, we know the brain has changed in size. We know that, like, there's a particular region of it, the cerebellum, that has relatively increased in size, even if the brain as a whole has shrunk. And it must mean something, although I couldn't tell you what. We also know that there have been changes in a lot of genes that appear to be involved in the brain, but most cases we don't know exactly what they do, the changes do.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Brad in Dallas. Hello, Brad.
Hi. My question, you mentioned earlier some of your own research and how you found a connection between an allele for the dopamine receptor and ADD. And I remember before in some of my own research, there might be a tenuous connection between a schizophrenia and a serotonin receptor. And schizophrenia affects about 1 in 100 people. And so my question was, I was wondering if in your own research, if you turned up any connections or possible benefits for why this allele might have arisen and spread, and what possible benefits there could be for an allele that kind of increases schizophrenia in the population.
I'm guessing you're talking about this famous serotonin transporter.
Mm-hmm.
I doubt if it's a very big schizophrenia risk. I mean, schizophrenia is not the thing I do most of my research on, but I do follow the literature. And, you know, people have been doing bigger and more careful studies trying to find genes strongly linked to schizophrenia. I mean, the one that would be most informative is one that makes quite a bit of difference and that quite a few people have, right? And there aren't any. In the sense that, for a common gene that makes a common variant of a gene that makes a lot of difference in schizophrenia risk, the more carefully they look, the less they find. What it looks as if, and by the way, I never expected you'd find anything that would have much of an influence. And the reason is anything that gave you that much of a problem probably wouldn't be common. Now, of course, they're somewhat at a loss because of this, but they're beginning to find that there's evidence is emerging, and this is all in the last year, really, or so, that the rare variants, rare ones that make a lot of difference, bad difference, are why you see these trends in families, but family X may have a completely different one than family Y, and that these bad mutations never become common because they give you schizophrenia, and schizophrenics have fewer children. When people have done studies of schizophrenia, medical studies, genetic studies, they're frustrated because the families are dwindling away because it's bad for you. So I would say that our best understanding, I don't claim we understand it that well right now, is that it's beginning to look as if schizophrenia is caused by a lot of different mutations that somehow screw up the brain, and that it's sort of the sum of all of those things. And in some sense, it's not a single disease. It's a lot of different diseases. This is also probably why a drug that seems helpful on a given person has a good chance it won't be helpful on the next person. Again, because the biochemical basis of this is probably varying a lot between different people. This is not great news for coming up with great new drugs. If each drug is only maybe going to work on a very small fraction of the patients. But I'd say that's what it looks like now.
Several questions via email about evolution and aggressive behavior and violent behavior. People are curious about whether Genghis Khan being this successful father made us all more violent, or whether we might be evolving away from violence because it doesn't work. What's your take on that?
Well, it worked for Genghis. you can trace Y chromosomes. You know, those are inherited directly in the male line. And there's an awful lot of people who are the sons of the sons of the sons of Genghis Khan. By an awful lot, I mean about 16 million. I mean, who, if they went back, you know, through their father and so forth, they end up directly to Genghis Khan. You know, it's about a quarter of a percent of all the men on Earth are direct male descendants of Genghis Khan, far more than anyone else. So it worked for him. But you have to think there's an awful lot of other people that didn't work for it, like anybody he ran into. There are genetic influences on things like violence. Again, in a given situation, they're going to work better or worse, being more or less violent. If I had to guess, I'd guess that on the whole, people have gotten less, because I think it's harder to make this work, again, unless you're Genghis Khan. Everything works for Genghis. It's harder to make it work. It's hard to make fighting work in a situation where you run into a lot of different people. Just because you're more crowded, I think you have to have have the fuse set a little lower. But I can give you one very interesting example of a family where we're pretty sure there is a genetic influence on violence. What have you heard of? It turns out that there's a particular mutation that causes its carriers to get benign tumors of the adrenal gland. It's a dominant. And those people get chock full of adrenaline. You know, they get mad for nothing. They stay mad. They can't control their temper very well. And there's a certain very large family in the area of East Tennessee where such a mutation happened to happen, and then, you know, descended. So half the people in this big family, very large family.
The Hatfields and the McCoys?
It's the McCoys.
Huh. Wow.
And I heard people said, yeah, it probably had nothing to do with it. And I said, really? I mean, inside the family, some people have it, some don't, and you can tell. because of the way their faces get bright red, you know, and their blood pressure goes up. And you have little girls who are, you know, about ready to explode over everything until you remove those tumors, and then they're acting more like a 10-year-old girl.
Wow.
So now that's a very unusual example, but it's interesting. I mean, and there have been other cases probably where, you know, something that's an interesting story or an interesting part of history is affected by a particular genetic, you know, thing that happens in a particular important family or something.
So the Hatfields were just unlucky enough to move in across the street.
Well, it really doesn't take two to make a quarrel, although I've certainly heard when people talk about Devil Aunt's Hatfield, I kind of wonder if maybe, you know, it's possibly troublemakers without this, you know. But you know, nobody needs help. And I'd have to say, I have to suspect that McCoys were mostly responsible, but hey, I wasn't there.
Let's go next to Joe in Fort Worth. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I've got a question for your guest. This is a general question about evolution. I've always wondered, I've never been able to figure out if genetic modification is possible during the life of an organism. In other words, if our ancestors moved from Africa, went north, and their skin pigmentation turned lighter, was that something that only the ones who survived were able to, I mean, only the ones who had light skin were able to survive, or were there modifications that took place that they passed on?
Probably some of both. I mean, people's skin responds to the sun, and you would be darker if you were exposed to a lot of sun. I mean, everybody responds some, but there's a range of response. I mean, so there's some people who, even if they got no sun, would still have fairly dark skin, your typical African, for example. And what happened, evidently, is that most cases, it looks like you needed to wait until a new mutation happened, which then made skin lighter, and then it spread. Probably the first people who moved out of Africa, it may have been a problem for them, I mean, in terms of getting enough vitamin D, although the right diet can help that. You know, maybe they were eating cod liver oil, I don't know. But the thing is, this is not instantaneous. You know, first you move in the Middle East, only later do you move farther north. It was probably 10 or 15,000 years before they moved into Europe after the Middle East. And that's enough time for some of these genetic changes with lighter skin to happen. Although, oddly enough, a lot of the ones we're finding appear to be fairly recent, like in the past 10,000 years. I don't think we entirely understand why. Another possibility is there are at least some populations inside Africa. Africa's a big place. Some places, you know, are not as sunny as the tropics. If you get down to South Africa, for example, it's more like the Mediterranean. And the original inhabitants of that area, the Bushmen, their skin is not as dark as other Africans. So there were at least some lighter skin genes around. But most of the light skin genes we find are new variants. And interestingly enough, they're different in China than Europe. People have fairly light skin in China, but the way in which they have light skin is essentially a completely different way than in say, Ireland.
We have an email from Jeff in Dallas who asks, what effect can in vitro fertilization have on human evolution?
Well, so far there's only been a little teeny tiny bit of it, so it hasn't had any effect. But I suppose if it was, this is projecting things being around for a thousand years in the future, and I don't really feel very confident doing that. But if it might be a way to get around certain fertility problems, so maybe there'd be less selection for correcting those fertility problems. I'm not sure.
What about the impact of this globalized culture we have now and our increasing tolerance for interracial marriage and intercultural marriage? Will we homogenize at some point?
If you're going at the current rate, the answer is yes. Not instantaneously, not in 100 years, not in 200, but certainly in less than 10,000. People, you know, until about 500 years ago when, you know, the big voyage of exploration connected all the continents, people were probably, on the whole, getting more different from each other. Let's say American Indians were getting more different than Europeans because they weren't mixing at all. But now they are. And in some populations, you know, mixing has been a tremendous impact. I mean, Mexico, for example, is typically the average person is about half Indian and half Spanish, roughly speaking. In other populations, it's much less. But, you know, the trend is definitely more towards mixing today. And I would presume that would continue. If it continued at half the current level, you would expect to get to the point eventually where most people had fairly mixed ancestry. But as I said, it would take time.
Does that mixed ancestry, if it's all somewhat similar 10,000 years down the line, does that afford us greater protections against some of the things that we've talked about, these disease issues that crop up? Or, in fact, are we homogenized to a great extent and therefore sort of susceptible to the smallpox, again, as we talked about Native American population?
Well, you know, one of the things is, you know, selection is an ongoing process, or at least it can be. For example, you know, we don't have any smallpox. So today, suppose somebody had a mutation that made them weaker against smallpox and had no other effect. Well, that mutation would do fine. That person would not die. That person would not have fewer kids. It doesn't have any consequences. If we keep smallpox where it belongs, which is nowhere, then it won't matter. But, I mean, I could say in a practical sense, like, suppose you had a person who was half Swedish and half, say, from Nigeria. Their mother and father came from those two places. He would probably not be as tough against malaria as somebody who was pure Nigerian. Would this be a problem? I said, I'm not sure. It might be. Again, if he lived in Nigeria and if he didn't have any access to the sort of drugs that control malaria. Now, what about in Sweden? I said, well, probably he'd be more likely to have a tendency towards shortage of vitamin D, but then he would just take vitamin D milk. You know, the question, a lot of it depends on whether the problem is still ongoing. If it's a problem we've solved, and if we keep it solved, again, that sort of assumes that civilization continues, then, you know, selection may not matter on those things. But if it did, you know, mixing people, in the long run, it adds new genes, and some of those are useful. The bad ones eventually go away, the hard way. The good ones spread. So a little bit of mixing, or even a lot, in the long run, ultimately is helpful.
Are we smart enough, Gregory, to choose the same adaptations for ourselves, assuming that we'll soon be in a position to engineer a lot of this, that nature would pick for us?
Probably not.
Huh.
I mean, look around you. I mean, think of what the people would do. I mean, in Texas, I'm sure that they'd be designing kids so that they're physically 19 when they're 17, sort of like, you know, built-in redshirting.
Mm-hmm. For football purposes, right.
Yes, of course. Don't you think so? I mean, look at the things people do in athletics, to give themselves an edge. Are those things usually sensible? No. I don't think the average person would be as crazy as a professional athlete or an Olympic wannabe. But, you know, we don't know a lot. But on the other hand, I said, look, if they try it and it works, it'll spread. And if they try it and it's a disaster, we'll probably not do it for a while.
Gregory Cochran is a physicist and also adjunct professor of anthropology at the University of Utah. His latest book, written with Henry Harpending, is called The 10,000-Year Explosion, How Civilization Accelerated Human Evolution. Gregory, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.